Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The number of American children allergic to peanuts has skyrocketed in recent years. For many kids, it's not just an inconvenience, it's a potentially life-threatening peril. This week, new research out with big new messages on the peanut front. Early exposure to peanuts may prevent allergies. A patch with peanut proteins could treat them. And a little less hyper-cleanliness in our lives may help with a lot of allergies. This hour on Point, new views on the allergy front. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you seen all the peanut allergies in your school, your community, peanut allergy families? How are you taking all this new research on board? What are your questions? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll talk about a new study that may let rats off the hook for the Black Death, the bubonic plague, and implicate gerbils. But first, to allergies. If you have this in your family, you know it's scary. Here's Dana Doherty, mother of Garrett, 10-year-old, has a peanut allergy. Mother and son have to be extremely conscious of everything he eats. Here in an interview with Jill Craig of the AP, she describes what happens if her son comes into contact with peanut.
He is anaphylactic, so if he eats or comes into contact with a peanut, he can go into anaphylactic shock, which is basically where his body shuts down and his airways close up.
As a parent, that will get your attention in a hurry. Dr. Rebecca Grushala joins us now from Dallas, Texas, professor of internal medicine and pediatrics, director of the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center at Dallas. She is co-author of an editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine this week, Preventing Peanut Allergy Through Early Consumption, Ready for Prime Time? On the new research that's getting all the reaction. Dr. Grushala, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And from Chicago, Dr. Ruchi Gupta is with us, associate professor of pediatrics at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, author of The Food Allergy Experience. Her own daughter is allergic to peanuts. Dr. Ruchi Gupta, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Great to be here, Tom.
Dr. Grushala, is it time to run out and give a little bit of peanut to all those babies that may be at risk? Exactly what have we learned with this research?
Well, I think the very important thing is that the research has indeed shown that in babies that are at risk for development of peanut allergy, that early introduction is something that we should start doing. Now, should everyone run out and do this? The answer to that is no, in that the parents need to work with the pediatricians and the allergy immunology specialists because of the fact that these babies will need to be skin tested, prick tested to peanut, and then it will need to be determined whether or not the introduction should occur in the allergist's office or if the parent can go ahead and introduce it at home. So again, it's going to be very important that parents don't rush out to do this, is what I'm saying. This needs to be in conjunction with physicians that know how to do food challenges.
Dr. Gupta, do you wish you had this research in hand when your own daughter was little? Might you have handled her infancy and food intake differently?
Well, it's really hard to say, Tom. You know, you had said earlier, 2% of kids in the United States have peanut allergy, and this is a growing problem. And peanut allergy can be very severe. It can cause, as that mother said, a life-threatening reaction. So I think it's really important to keep all of this in mind. It's a very common thing. Now, when my daughter was little, and we did withhold peanuts to some extent, but not completely. You know, the data on this has been so inconclusive, and I think that's why it's so exciting to have this research. As a pediatrician, you know, parents ask us this question frequently. You know, should I introduce, should I not? And the AAP recommendations have changed from 2000 to 2008 because we had no evidence. So it's really tough to say. You know, as Dr. Grishala said, we really do need to, you know, take this evidence. It's very, very important, but still be a little bit cautious, you know, when counseling families.
But, I mean, during these years from 2000 to 2008, Dr. Grishala, the message was don't give peanut to your at-risk babies, right?
That is exactly right. During that time, the recommendation was to withhold until 3 years of age. But as we were recommending that, we were also seeing a rise in peanut allergy prevalence.
So quadrupled or something over the last 13
years. Correct.
That is skyrocketing.
So the experts got back together and said, no, there's not sufficient evidence to show. In fact, there's very little evidence to show that this is helpful and may indeed be harmful. So that is why they reconvened and devised the new guidelines that came out in 2008.
I want to step back and go through this very carefully. First of all, you say this research was done with babies. Was it 4 months to 11 months, right?
Correct.
And they were at-risk babies. And what does that mean, Dr. Grishala, at-risk for peanut allergy?
Are children, they actually looked at individuals or babies that were actually at high risk for the development of peanut allergy. And Dr. Tadkois and Lack had actually identified those babies in a previous studies, and those were children with severe eczema as well as with egg allergy. However, other studies have shown that have been published in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology by Christine Joseph and Christine Johnson, they actually showed that children from atopic parents, meaning children from parents that have allergies, may also be at risk for developing peanut allergy. They may not be in the highest risk, but they're also at risk. So what Gideon Lack and Dr. Dutois decided to do was to focus on the highest risk children. But there may be other children that are at risk as well. And that is why Dr. Sampson and I in the editorial mm-hmm. suggested that we might want to look beyond just children with a severe eczema and allergy to include those also with allergies or those from atopic parents.
But here's my question. I've got a million, but to start with this one. If highly at-risk babies, it's suggested with this research, and I understand there's still things to be worked out here, but it's suggested maybe they should have some exposure to peanut. Doesn't that mean that all babies would be, I mean, why not just suggest all babies have a little exposure to peanut? If you're not at risk, it won't hurt you, and if you are, it might help you.
Well, and I think I will refer to my pediatric colleague here. Right now, the guidelines state introduction of solid food beyond 4 months of age. And children that are not at risk, there would not be any reason to withhold.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to make any firm statements mm-hmm. at this time. I think, again, the experts need to come together, and they are doing that very quickly in order to set out some new guidelines for all physicians, general pediatricians, and allergists, immunologists, and other subspecialties.
So we fully get that, and talk to your doctor before you act on any of this, and it's not all settled, so you know, don't rush out and start spooning peanut butter all over the place. But Dr. Gupta, is the suggestion in this, in a very basic way, that 4 months on, a little peanut might be good for most kids, all kids? I want to be very careful here and talk to your doctor. But
So currently, you know, we don't say don't feed peanut anymore. So mm-hmm. when parents come to us with their, you know, 4-month-old child, we say, you know, you can start introducing solids. We have a, you know, regimen of introducing it slowly, you know, one food every couple days. And then, you know, but we don't. Already, we are not saying, you know, withhold peanut. So this doesn't change it drastically. We do say go ahead and feed your child, you know, whatever you would. No full peanuts for choking,
mm-hmm.
but peanut butter is fine. So this doesn't change the current recommendation. What it does is it gives us some evidence that, you know, introducing peanut butter, peanut products may actually be somewhat protective. So you know, as Dr. Grishala said, it's important for us to have that conversation with a family and for families to know that, especially if they have no risk factors, you know, they may go ahead and introduce. And then be very careful and observant in watching their child. If they see hives break out or any difficulty breathing or any symptoms or signs, then they need to be, you know, very aware of that. So having a discussion around what to look for, what an allergic reaction looks like.
And for an at-risk infant, at this point at which peanut might be introduced, how much and how would it be given? Are you just putting a dab into their baby food, or is this something else?
Oh, that's a very important question. In the study that was done, they were introducing, 2 grams three times a week.
About how much and is 2 grams, Dr. Grishala?
2 grams is a little over 2 teaspoons.
Okay.
And it's going to be, so we're talking about 2 teaspoons in a week, like 2 to 3 teaspoons in a week. So the question is, you know, how would you distribute this? And then what happens if the peanut butter was missed, like during 1 week mm-hmm. or 2 weeks? Those are very, very important questions because these babies in the study were evaluated very, very closely so that they didn't miss doses, so
right.
to speak. And what would happen if doses were missed? Well, you know, we would the I don't want to use the word tolerance, mm-hmm. but the ability to tolerate the peanut protein, would that be lost? That's why you're going to have to work with your physician as we're going through this process.
Dr. Gupta, a home is not a laboratory setting. Does the micro measurement and precise delivery of this appear to matter?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to scare families into you have to be very, very precise. You know, and currently, like I said, the recommendations don't say, you know, don't feed this to your child. So, you know, I think having an idea, like the 2 teaspoons or, you know, about this amount. But if a child has no risk factors, is not sensitized, then, you know, chances are they'll be able to eat the food, you know, just like any other food. So hopefully for those kids, the kids who we have to be more careful with are those kids who may have risk factors.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about new breakthroughs on peanut allergies, treatment and prevention. And the question will come to it when it comes to allergies and maybe more, are we too clean for our own good? Dr. Ruchi Gupta is with us from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago, author of The Food Allergy Experience. Her own daughter has a peanut allergy. Dr. Rebecca Grishala is with us. She was co-author of the editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine this week, where the findings of this new research have been discussed in depth. She joins us from Dallas, Texas, and the Division of Allergy and Immunology at University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center at Dallas. It can be really tricky out there. Peanuts can show up in all kinds of places. You know how hard it is to avoid them. Here's just a little bit from Conan in September. Comedian and actor Bill Hader, who has a severe peanut allergy, described what looked to him like a brush with death.
Someone came over to me and said, "Hey, do you want some chocolates?" And I said, "Well, I have a peanut allergy." And they went, "No, these are just chocolates. Don't worry about it. There's no peanuts in this." Mm-hmm. And I went, "Oh, great." And I put it in my mouth, and it was filled with peanut butter. And I went,
"Who is this person?"
I went, "This is peanut butter." And I said, and they said, "Oh, you said peanuts." And I said, "So this is how I die."
He's a comedian, but for many families, this is not funny. Megan in Warren, Pennsylvania is calling. Hi, Megan. You're on the air with Dr. Grishala and Dr. Gupta.
Hi, Tom. I just want to say thank you for having a program like this. As a mother of a son with peanut allergy, a severe peanut allergy, it can be so scary and isolating. There's a lack of understanding and I think oftentimes empathy. It's a relatively new issue. And for my son, it's a real, you know, life-threatening issue that I protect him from at all times. So, you know, I just want to say thank you for a show like this. And hopefully with the awareness that's coming out and the new studies that there can be a real advancement.
It takes a lot of vigilance. What do you think of the new, you know, what's moving toward a new recommendation here? It's not yet, you know, it's not all sewn up here yet. But what do you think about the gist of these findings, Megan?
Well, I think it's good. My son was 1 when he was diagnosed with a peanut allergy when I gave him a peanut butter sandwich on his birthday. We had no food allergies in our family at all. I had nursed him and I had eaten peanut butter. We had peanut butter everywhere. So he was exposed to it frequently, I would say, through his whole life. So when he was diagnosed and he developed his hives and quickly went into anaphylactic shock, it was just completely blindsided for all of us.
What a birthday party. That must have been hair-raising.
It was. But, you know, we are very hypervigilant now, and there's a stigma sometimes that we are trying, that it's a lifestyle change or that I'm a helicopter parent or things like that. And, you know, just keeping him safe and raising awareness is my main goal in life at this point.
I appreciate your call, Megan. Dr. Grushala, does nursing and eating peanuts or peanut butter impart some of this benefit to a child, or is that a different thing?
That's a totally different thing, actually, and I think the studies are still out there, and it was very interesting what Megan was saying, that he was exposed and then on his first birthday had a major reaction. And yet she was eating peanut butter during nursing. So that is telling us that, you know, we just don't know. We just don't know the answer to those questions.
There's a lot still here to learn. Let's get a call from Los Angeles, California. Saad is calling. Saad, it's been a long time. It's wonderful to hear from you. What do you think?
Thank you, Tom. Nice to hear from you again as well. I would like to actually make a little bit of a bold statement. I think that the recent epidemic of allergies to foods, and specifically to peanut, is iatrogenic, which means I believe that it has been caused partly by our recommendations, which have been completely incorrect. There's a certain period in the human being's life or a child's life where if you introduce something, and especially if you introduce it at a little bit of a higher dose, you can develop something called immune tolerance. Mm-hmm. And this period is very short. It's in the first few months of a person's life. And I think we have definitely missed the point on recommending complete strict avoidance in the first few months of life. Now it's 180 degrees. It's the other way around. Now we're saying introduce early in life because you can develop tolerance and prevent allergies.
Saad, you're a doctor. You're an allergist, I believe. It's been some years since that strict guidance against any exposure was the sort of big message, right? Are allergists, have they still been telling parents keep entirely away, Saad?
Well, I've always been skeptical about that recommendation when it comes to my patients and to my own children as well. I've actually told them to introduce early in life, and I think this prevents allergies sometimes.
Saad, I appreciate your call. Dr. Gupta, is there no such thing as hard and fast allergy? I mean, immune tolerance suggests even if you may have some propensity toward allergy, just build up a tolerance. Is that always possible?
So it's a great question, and these are great perspectives. I mean, I think the study is validating what Dr. Saad was just saying in the sense of early introduction could prevent or could, you know, help develop that tolerance to food allergies. But I also want to go back to what the mother, Megan, was saying, because when you experience an allergic reaction to a peanut as a mother and a child, it is severe and it's life-threatening, and children have died from a peanut allergy. So there is a balance there. And this condition is so different than any other pediatric condition because, you know, these children are fine. And then on exposure to even the smallest amount, we've seen some really scary reactions.
I mean, I'm reading here from Dr. Grushala's editorial, peanut allergy has become the leading cause of anaphylaxis and death related to food allergy in the United States. That's serious.
And so, I would like to.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Could I break in here and say one thing about the last speaker's comment? And immune tolerance is something that yes, we need to study. And I think the critical thing that this new study has shown is that we need to look at the cellular and molecular mechanisms that are leading to this ability to tolerate peanut. And by looking at that we can understand the immune system better so that indeed maybe we can start introducing foods early and developing this tolerance in at-risk individuals. The issue, though, is it's very difficult to do basic research like this on infants. It's an, a whole other story when we're looking at a mouse model, which there have been many studies on immune tolerance in animal models. But doing this in humans, we have to be very, very careful. But we also do need to do the studies to look at the molecular and cellular mechanisms so that we can target interventions for these children at risk.
Elaine in Omaha, Nebraska. Thank you for calling, Elaine. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is, the issue has always been about the Western part of the world using roasted peanuts and the Asian part of the world using cold-pressed peanuts. And it's the roasting that seems to induce the allergens. And there was a recent article in the Allergy Journal that stated that they had found a particular allergen in a roasted peanut. Is the Academy of Allergy and the researchers working in conjunction with industry to move to a less allergenic peanut product in general?
Great question.
So people can feel safe about using it?
Dr. Gushala, may I come first to you on that?
Yes, that's a very, very good question. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, or it absolutely. Roasted peanuts are more allergenic than the, say, the boiled peanut. But working with industry, I honestly don't know the answers to that question. It would be great if we did make a change, but that would be a pretty hefty kind of cultural change in our country to go from roasted peanuts to something that we haven't done forever and ever. But we definitely do know that roasted peanuts are more allergenic, and it'd be great if we could work with industry to kind of move the other direction.
So a processing piece to this as well. Dr. Gupta, what about the news this week as well about a peanut skin patch for those who have are already established to have a peanut allergy, but a patch that may help them actually treat that allergy? What have we learned there, Dr. Gupta?
Yes, I mean, that's also very exciting news. I mean, currently on the front end, you know, studies looking at how to prevent allergies in children. But then for all the children who already have allergies, what are some treatments that we could have? So the patch is a great potential treatment because it is simple to use. It goes on the skin as opposed to the oral immunotherapy where a child has to actually ingest the food that they're allergic to. I think it's really promising. You know, the ability for all these immunotherapies to desensitize the child. So meaning if the child stays with it, that they can tolerate a certain amount of peanuts versus having them kind of become tolerant, or what we sometimes refer to as like outgrow, so that they can eat as many as they want every day, is still yet unknown. So, but again, I think it's very promising and very exciting.
Dr. Gushala, what portion of those allergic with peanut allergies might be helped by a patch, and what could its effect be? Is it, do you have to be wearing it all the time to develop a kind of, is it a prophylactic effect or a treatment effect, actually curative?
Well, I it's a treatment effect, but I we can't go as far as saying that it's curative. The data was just presented by Dr. Sampson's group at our recent national meeting in Houston. And what it showed is that a patch, when they would wear it, that you could actually tolerate up to, I believe it was 4 peanuts. And so what this is this helpful so that if you have accidental ingestion, because as you know, many of these people are exquisitely sensitive, and just a small amount of peanut can trigger an anaphylactic reaction. So people, if they had some type of a treatment option that allowed them not to eat a peanut candy bar, but allowed them to know that they were not going to have a severe reaction if, say, they had an accidental ingestion, this would be just a tremendous help and to allay the fear of the child and the parent.
So this would be a patch that they'd wear. Peanut proteins come into the skin. Would they wear it all the time or for a certain amount of time a week? Or what's the idea?
I'm sure the patch, I actually, like I said, this was just presented. It's not actually in published form yet. So I'm sure the patch would have to be changed because, you know, over a certain period of time.
Of course. But I mean, the idea would be if you had this allergy, you would always be wearing a patch, or only if you I don't know.
No, I think the answer to that is it would have to, because I think this is for desensitization, meaning as long as you had the patch on, mm-hmm. you would be able to tolerate the peanut. I don't think the studies were looking at did you actually become tolerant, meaning that if you took the patch away and didn't have any peanut exposure and then ate peanut, that you would be A-okay. I don't know, but I think it was looking at desensitization.
Now, I want to come to this research. I guess this is out of Sweden on hygiene and the suggestion that hypercleanliness, Dr. Gupta, may actually be setting us up for more allergies. What do you see in this research?
So, yes, this is also very interesting. It's a new, type of study in this area looking at, you know, dishwashing. But I think the whole idea revolves around this theory that people have been talking about for a while. You know, as a society, are we becoming too clean? And is it decreasing our exposures to bacterias or viruses that could potentially prove helpful for preventing allergies? I think it's a really interesting study. I mean, there's studies that have been done looking at, you know, family size. That's where the hygiene hypothesis originally came from. And then also, you know, daycare.
What does that mean? Bigger families just couldn't keep things as clean? Or?
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the number
Too
of siblings you have.
Too many people running around. Okay.
Yeah, you have
more
exposures.
Yeah.
You know, and as family size has decreased, mm-hmm. Does that have some interplay. But then, you know, a lot of things come along with that. You had mentioned soaps and antibacterial soaps, and then the whole daycare environment, you know, the food we're eating, microbial exposures. So there are a lot of potential environmental triggers and understanding what it is. Because as we saw in the original study, you know, the Gideon Lack study, when kids who were even sensitized, who may have had some genetic potential to develop an allergy, were exposed to peanuts, many of them did not eventually develop that allergy, at least for the length of the study. So there may be a trigger, and obviously it's genetic and environment. So understanding what that environmental trigger is so critical for our understanding of this increase in food allergies and whether that is hygiene related.
Let's go to New Orleans. Chris is calling. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a point related to this issue of cleanliness, and there was a study I read at some point discussing parasites actually can use the more attenuative side of the immune system for the development of allergies. And I was wondering if your panelists had any comments about parasites, either just exposure to them or as a potential treatment for allergies. And then the second quick point I wanted to make was I read another article that in Israel, the common baby food, so instead of, you know, Cheerios and feeding biscuits that they feed their children, is a puff that's made from a peanut base, and that the rates of peanut allergies in Israel are actually extraordinarily low. And wondering if they had any comments about this idea of kind of early exposure decreasing the rate of peanut allergies, and that would at least be correlative.
Yeah, Chris, let us go there. I appreciate your call. Dr. Grushala, parasites and cleanliness. This takes it yet another step. I mean, the Swedish study, 1,000 or so kids there, they compared families where dishes were washed by hand compared mm-hmm. to those where they were washed in a dishwasher. A little more bacteria hanging around with their hand washed, and they said this was a positive thing, but that was just bacteria. Parasite exposure? What do you say?
Well, possibly so as well. I think the original studies that were done in Europe by Erica von Mutius was showing that if you actually lived on a farm, that you were less likely to have asthma and allergies. And I think one point I want to get across here is that it's not only peanut allergy and food allergies that are rising in the population, but also eczema, asthma, and allergies in general. And so this idea of the hygiene hypothesis that we are a little too clean, and if you're raised on a farm, you get more exposure to bacteria and endotoxin and maybe parasites, and then you don't have as much development of allergy. But again, other things are playing a role too, because look at children in the inner city. Asthma is rising very high, very much in this yeah. individual population. And these folks are exposed to a lot of bacteria. So there are other environmental factors such as diet, exposure, say, to pollution, and those types of things that are playing a role.
Thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about allergies, peanut allergies, how clean may be too clean when it comes to developing allergies, with Dr. Rebecca Grushala in Dallas, Texas, at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center there, co-author of the editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine this week that goes at this new research and dissecting it. Dr. Ruchi Gupta is with us from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, author of The Food Allergy Experience, joins us from Chicago. We're going to look before this hour is over at a potential connection way back in Europe between gerbils and the bubonic plague, but peanut allergies front and center, a new patch they're talking about, which might give some protection against those severe reactions. And those can be scary. Sunday, CBS News profiled one of the kids currently testing out this patch. He's so allergic that even something like a handshake can be dangerous.
9-year-old Josh Mandelbaum is fearless on the tennis court. Not so much when it comes time for the handshake.
I was scared that if I shook someone else's hand, that I could have a reaction.
A little patch, if it helped, would be very welcome right there. Lots of questions and interesting insights here from our listeners. Cleveland, Ohio. Rachel is calling. Rachel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just want to thank you all so much for having this program and raising awareness. I think that there isn't enough, and I see how my son, who struggles with a peanut allergy and tree nut allergy, is isolated and greatly affected socially. And actually, my question was about the cleanliness, because I feel like we didn't become clean freaks until we had to deal with this and all the cross-contamination, but that was kind of answered from another caller's question. So maybe I'd just like to ask, is there any development for things like patches in the tree nut allergies for the children that don't just suffer from the severe peanut allergy?
So tree nut, is that, that's walnuts and everything else that you might have in a nut mix, Rachel? Is that the idea?
Yes, peanuts and all tree nuts. He's anaphylaxis reaction to all.
Dr. Grushala, what about other nuts? Are they implicated? Is there any implication for them in this new research?
While I don't know of any particular research that's going on, I'm sure there is this type of research with other tree nuts as well as with eggs and milk. My colleagues at University of North Carolina, Mount Sinai Hospital, as well as at many other places in the country and the world, mm-hmm. are focusing on prevention as well as treatment for current allergy to tree nuts and other things as well. It's just that that data is not yet published. So I think there will be hope out there for children with not only peanut allergy, but other nut allergies and other type food allergies.
Let me put this to you from a listener writing to us online, Matt. Now, Matt takes this whole hygiene thing pretty far, but he says, if all these studies which suggest that parents let their kids root around in filth to build their immune systems are true, well, that may be a bit exaggerated, but even so. He says, why don't doctors just introduce those needed harmful microbes in a more controlled manner? So you get exposed to a smorgasbord of tiny bacteria just like you get your vaccine. Is there something about the particular microbiome of your home that cannot be duplicated in a controlled way? Dr. Gupta, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, that would be great if we knew exactly what those were. You know, if we had an answer, and this is what researchers, again, in the U.S. and all around the world are looking at. What are these specific microbiota that people need to prevent things like allergies? So as soon as we have the answer, I think that is a fabulous idea. I also wanted to mention that, you know, having one food allergy, like just a peanut allergy, is very rare. Most children do have multiple food allergies. And some research we've done, you know, we really did find that not only do kids have typically more than one. So if you have a peanut allergy, there's a high chance you'll have a tree nut allergy. And then same with milk, egg, you know, soy, wheat, shellfish, finfish. A lot of these things go together. So there are researchers around the country that are trying to study multi-foods, kids who have multiple food allergies, and developing, you know, immunotherapies to, you know, combat all of them at once. Because as that parent said, you know, you cannot just control one food allergy. You still have your child who has multiple others. So it does get challenging.
Dan in Augusta, Georgia. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Mine's sort of parallel with allergies. My wife has suffered with allergies over the years, but it's usually the hay fever and the pollen.
Mm-hmm.
And she had read about taking local honey, and that in theory would have local pollen in it, mm-hmm. that would help build up a tolerance and help, you know, you basically your body learns how to deal with it.
Yep.
But I also noticed on a lot of the honey bottles it says do not feed to children under the age of one. So I'm just kind of like, and of course honey is also in a lot of healthy foods.
Dan, let us pick it up. Our time is short, but Dr. Grushala, that is wide advice. Don't give honey to babies. Why?
That I have not heard of, so I cannot answer that question.
Huh.
I'm going to defer to my pediatric colleague. Yeah.
Dr. Gupta?
All right. Yeah. So we don't give honey to children under one because of the fear of botulism. And so it's rare, but it does occur. And so, but after one, you are more than welcome to have as much honey as you like.
But are you denying them the exposure to local allergens that might give them immunity?
Well, I think you can find this in other stuff, too. Mm-hmm. But I do love the honey theory, and I personally believe in it, especially for seasonal allergies. We talk about it a lot. So the other piece is like things like yogurt. Yogurt have natural microbiota, mm-hmm. biota in it,
sure.
which is also very good. So I do agree that there are many natural things in our environment that we should be able to give our children, to potentially give them, that good bacteria or the good natural things that they need to hopefully prevent these allergies.
Dr. Grushala, just sit back for a second here. We've just got a couple of minutes. But with these numbers, up from 0.4% of kids peanut allergic in 97 to 2%, now that's quadrupled in just that dozen plus years. At that rate is a scary rate, and it puts a lot of kids in a tough situation. Why do you think this is happening? People look around and just cannot figure out why we have so many allergies among our children now.
Well, again, as we were talking about before, there are multiple reasons why allergies are increasing across the world, predominantly in westernized countries. We think that it does have to do with potentially environmental exposures as well as our microbiome, exactly as we were discussing. Are we eating different foods that are changing our gut so that we are now not tolerating certain foods the way we used to in the past? Obesity is probably playing a role in certain things as well, such as asthma. We're having we have a different lifestyle now. We're not running around outside exercising our bodies and our lungs. Our diets are different. Our exposures in the cities are different with respect to pollutants and other irritants. So it's very multifactorial, and we're in the process of teasing out what these different factors are that are contributing to this rise.
You're saying some foods may be tilting us toward allergy, and I'm sure they'll wonder, what foods? I'll cut them out right away. Like what?
No. I don't mean that any certain foods are mm-hmm. causing that are leading. One of the things that vitamin D deficiency has been shown that maybe that is playing a particular role. I didn't mean that any particular food was leading to the development of allergy by any means.
It's big with a lot of factors at play, but some new horizon opened up for us, and maybe how to push in the other direction this week. And it's great to have this good conversation about what we may ultimately learn and implement from that. Talk to your doctor, but there may be hope on the horizon here. Dr. Rebecca Grushala in Dallas, Texas, thank you so much for being with us today, Doctor.
Thank you.
And Dr. Ruchi Gupta in Chicago. Thank you, Dr. Gupta. Great to have you with us again.
Thanks, Tom. My pleasure.
Good luck with all those children. In a moment, rats have been blamed for spreading the Black Death to Europe for centuries, but could there have been another culprit? This is On Point. The Black Death, or bubonic plague, killed as many as 200 million in Europe in outbreaks from the 14th to the 19th centuries. And for centuries, the plague's spread was blamed on rats. Now, new research on climate history suggests that rats may not have been to blame. The real culprit? Maybe gerbils. Joining me now from Oslo, Norway, is Nils Christian Stenseth, research professor and chair of the Center for Ecological and Evolutionary Synthesis at the University of Oslo. He's author of a new study tracking climate history and plague outbreaks. Nils Christian Stenseth, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello. Very happy to be here.
Where did the theory of rats' culpability come from, sir?
Well, that has been the story that has been hanging around for a long, long time, that it was rats or another rodent reservoir, rodent species that hosted the plague bacterium, Yersinia pestis. That has been the story. And as a matter of fact, I believed myself that in some rodent species that the bacterium would have persisted during the Black Death and subsequent several hundred years thereafter. However, we have analyzed the relationship or tried to search for a relationship between plague outbreaks in Europe and climate in Europe. Because if there is a rodent reservoir in Europe causing the Black Death and the various various epidemics that followed the Black Death, the start of the Black Death, you would expect that there was a climatic relationship. I've been studying small rodents for a very, very long time, and I have long experience with that. But we found no such relationship. However, we found a relationship between the climatic conditions that are good for gerbils, being a reservoir species in Central Asia, and the plague showing up in Europe some 12 to 15 years thereafter.
How would a gerbil get from Central Asia to Europe to carry the plague there?
It's not the gerbil that goes from Central Asia to Europe. It is the plague bacterium that somehow are transported to Europe, most probably through some caravans along the Silk Road or other major trade routes.
Were there rats all over Europe in those centuries?
It was not rats all over Europe. It was rats in part of Europe, but not all over Europe where you had the plague.
And how have you done your research? How does climate come in here? What you're looking at plague outbreaks and whether they corresponded with climatic conditions that would suit the rapid spread of disease by rat fleas?
There are reconstructions of climate through history and for the actual period that we are studying. There are reconstructions of climatic variation in Europe, and there are climate reconstructions of climate variation in Central Asia. We have used these data and see whether there is a correlation between the climatic variation in Europe and the occurrence of plague in Europe, and there was none. And then we have also searched for a relationship between climatic variation in Central Asia, and a few years later, 10 to 15, we found, or 12 to 15 years later, it shows up in harbor cities, primarily in Europe, and then spread inland.
I think a lot of people, when they associate bubonic plague with rats, they imagine rats actually spreading the disease. But you're saying it may have come from a population of gerbils in Central Asia. Only the bacteria would have come on the caravan. Does that mean the plague spread without rodents carrying it around? It spread human to human?
Well, it could have been rats or other small rodents on the caravans. It could also have been dormant fleas that stayed in clothes in the caravans and then were activated when they came in right condition, for instance, in Europe.
And these gerbils, how is a gerbil different from a rat? I have to admit, I mean, I've seen them, I can see, but genetically, are they different from rats?
Well, they are very. It's a very different species. It's a rodent species. Both. It's a very different species. It has a. It's a colony living species, which rats are not. So they live underground in colonies, mm-hmm. in semi-dried dry areas. What we have studied this since 2002 in Kazakhstan and now later in China. We have learned a few things that are very relevant here. For a plague outbreak to occur within a gerbil population, which is a gnat, remember that the plague is a wildlife disease primarily and not primarily a human disease.
Mm-hmm.
It has a tremendous negative effect on the human population if they are infected, but it's primarily a rodent wildlife disease.
Mm-hmm.
If in order to get a outbreak within the rodent population, you need to have a high density of rodents for a couple of years. Then there might be an outbreak. If it's below that that density, it will never be an outbreak, we have seen. So good condition for gerbils to be at high densities are warm and somewhat wet summers.
May I ask, we always hear about the bubonic plague in Europe, but if the gerbils were living in or near China, were there also Black Death, bubonic plague outbreaks in China with mass death?
Yes, indeed. Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. In China and in Kazakhstan. That was a disease, and it still is a disease in that part of the world.
And finally, for all those listeners who may have a gerbil parked in their child's bedroom or in a cage in the kitchen, is there any risk associated with pet gerbil today?
There is absolutely no risk for the gerbils that people have in their house. Gerbils, in order to be dangerous, they have to be infected by the plague bacterium, and I'm sure they are not.
The word gerbil, the name, sounds funny in English. Does it sound funny in Norwegian?
No, no. We call it the desert rats in the Norwegian translation.
Desert rats. That makes it a little less exotic, but...
It's less exotic, yeah, I agree.
But what interesting research. Maybe the rat is redeemed a little bit in this research. Niels Christian Stenseth at the University of Oslo, thank you for your research and thank you for joining us today, sir.
And thank you very much for your interest.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.